Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
Quite frankly, it's just f***ed up in our community. And us, I know people get tired of hearing me say it, but we are scared as black people in America. Black men, black women, black kids, we are terrified.
All you do is keep hearing about fear. It's amazing to me why we keep loving this country and this country does not love us back.
That was Doc Rivers, head coach of the LA Clippers, and LeBron James of the Los Angeles Lakers, two of the best-known figures in the NBA, speaking last week after the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Now, when Rivers says why we keep loving this country, and this country does not love us back, well, just listen for a moment to how strongly that echoes another athlete's fierce accusation from more than five decades ago when he said, "You won't even stand up for me here at home."
My name is a white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
That, of course, is Muhammad Ali from 1967. Now, Ali stood relatively alone in athletics back then, and he paid a heavy price for speaking out. This time around in 2020, American athletics showed a swift and remarkable solidarity in taking action against racial injustice. On Wednesday of last week, the Milwaukee Bucks first refused to take to the court for their playoff game against Orlando. Guard Sterling Brown was one of the players who read the team statement.
Over the last few days in our home state of Wisconsin, we've seen the horrendous video of Jacob Blake being shot in the back seven times by a police officer in Kenosha, and the additional shooting of protesters. Despite the overwhelming plea for change, there has been no action. So our focus today cannot be on basketball.
And the rest of the basketball world soon followed. The entire NBA stepped off the court, then the WNBA, then Major League Soccer and baseball. So for a few days there, much of the sports world in the United States spoke with one voice. But it only lasted a few days. 3 days later on Saturday, play resumed in the NBA. And while the duration of this action might have been short, the history of athletes and activism is long. We mentioned Ali already. And more recently, in 2016, after the fatal police shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, athletes such as the NBA's Carmelo Anthony spoke out.
The events of the past week have put a spotlight on the injustice, distrust, and anger that plagues so many of us. The system is broken. The problems are not new. The violence is not new. And the racial divide definitely is not new.
A month later, NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick drew national attention and presidential ire when he decided to kneel during the national anthem.
I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change.
Well, this hour on Point, we're going to take a look at sports activism, its history, its present, and its future. And joining us today is Howard Bryant. He's senior writer at ESPN and commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. He's also the author of Full Dissidence and The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and The Politics of Patriotism. Howard, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Meghna, how are you?
I'm doing all right. We're also joined today by Amira Rose Davis. She's assistant professor of history and African-American studies at Penn State University and co-host of Burn It All Down, a podcast. Amira, welcome to you.
Yeah, thanks.
So I wanted to first start by just getting a sense from both of you about what you thought, what your reactions were to how quickly So many players and teams decided to take decisive action, at least for several days. Last week, Howard, what were your first thoughts?
Well, my first thoughts were that it wasn't swift, is that this has been in the works for a long time. And I think that when you think about this period, it really has been almost a decade. And for this generation, you have to go back to the Miami Heat and Trayvon Martin back in 2012. When I thought about this, the players walking off the court, I thought about 2014 when the NBA players, the Los Angeles Clippers, had threatened to boycott over the Donald Sterling scandal, but yet they decided to play. There had been numerous examples where the athletes had walked up to the line but weren't willing to cross it. And then once they did, the next thing that hit me was the coordinated action of it, because we've seen a lot of things, and Amira, you've studied a lot of this, as I've studied a lot of this over the last 75 years, but we've never seen what we saw next, which was a coordinated action across sports, where one domino fell in the NBA, then the rest of the NBA slate fell, and then basketball, and then the WNBA, and then tennis, and hockey, and baseball. And that was the new part for me. And it was a real question about whether this was a coordinated action and what was going to come of that. Those were the initial thoughts I had.
Mm-hmm. And Amira, your initial thoughts?
Yeah, very much along the same lines. I thought this was something that had been building, especially this summer, which has been a long, hot summer. And I think it also comes out of the fact that we started this summer in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, where you saw a lot of leads, a lot of corporations around the country kind of lean in to Black Lives Matter, lean in to like corporate commodified activism. And I think that one of the things that was articulated and built to this moment was this idea that like these baby steps are not going far enough. Painting a court, having a commercial may not be far enough for us. And like Howard said, there has been walking up to the line, there had been toying with it, occasional individuals who stepped over that line of actually withholding their athletic labor. And so that initial action didn't surprise me as much as that domino effect, because we're talking about the NBA and the WNBA, who have been leaders, you know, over the past 8 years in this new generation, this new wave of athletic activism. But when it's hitting sports like baseball, like hockey, when Naomi Osaka is bringing it to pro tennis, that is a different complexity. That is, that requires the buy-in of leagues and athletes in leagues that are not predominantly Black. And to me, that was part of what was unprecedented about that night.
Yeah, and Amira, I was going to jump in and just jump on one more thing you said, too, is that it also made me think about when we talk about coordination, because when you see the WNBA, okay, we've been following this for a long time, that's player-driven. When you saw what happened in the NBA, that's player-driven. Naomi Osaka did what she did individually. Tennis is an individual sport. But then the USTA got on board. The NHL got on board. And so then I started to wonder, when we saw what happened in baseball, that was player-driven. You had a couple of players who were like, we're not gonna play. And then when you see the other sports started to move in with the NHL and the USTA, now you're wondering, is this player-driven or is this league-driven? And I got a lot of calls, Magna, from players asking me, was it the responsibility of the leagues now to recognize that the country's at a fragile point, that they wrote this enormous check after the George Floyd killing, that they were going to be in line on this and that this mattered to them as a league? Was it also their responsibility to step in and say, hey, do you want to play, or maybe it's a good idea for us not to? So the shift of this isn't just, okay, the players are active, but it seems that the leagues as well are recognizing that this is a component that they've got to factor into as well. That's very, very different from the past.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And just to be clear, sorry, Amir, I didn't mean to jump in on you there, but just to be clear, so both of you are saying that this action, as begun by players, then was ultimately league-driven? I mean, because I think, Howard, I keep hearing you ask that in the form of a question. Do we know for sure?
Well, I think that what we do know is that I don't think the NHL was completely player driven. I don't think, and clearly the USTA wasn't, because Naomi Osaka said she wasn't playing. And then the next day, the entire USTA shut down for the day. And I have not seen anyone and heard anyone, people that I've spoken with, I never heard that there was some groundswell of the players during the Western and Southern Open say, okay, as a group, we're not playing. They didn't do that. There was one player who really came out and spoke. And then the USTA took blanket action, which which was sort of mysterious, but was also very interesting. We still haven't heard a group of tennis players come out and say, yes, we did not. We all agreed that we weren't playing. It really was one player. And then the organization, the governing body, took over.
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, I think that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that part of this is what happens when you put yourself into a branding corner. When you, as a brand, are tweeting out Black Lives Matter, if you are releasing statements in June, right, we're what it feels like pandemic years are funny, but we're not too far removed from that. And so I think one of the other things in operation here is that leagues have also put themselves in a position where this is the test. This is like, all right, you've said this, you put the statements, you've donated some money or, you know, created a task force, and here we are again. And I think that some of the calculations that perhaps, you know, we can see operating in various ways, but the, you know, part of what Howard's pointing to is, when does it go from, you know, athletic labor, like that withholding of it, athlete driven thing, to league saying, whether it's sincere, out of sincerity or out of a kind of brand consideration or out of a desire to, you know, kind of give a little bit to protect their other interests, but saying, if we postpone, if we join this, if this has become a domino, and now that spotlight on us as another league that's participating is glowing every time a league steps up and say, hey, we're postponing for the next 2 days, the light on us only gets bigger. And the calls for us to follow suit only gets louder. And I think that that's the very interesting kind of interaction where, you know, we can see the process really be athlete driven. And then it gets a little murkier as we, you know, get to some of these other dominoes that fell.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've just got about 30 seconds left to go. So I want to first just ask you, Amira, I hear both of you saying that really what we saw last week indeed was different and unprecedented, but it also didn't last that long. So how much of an impact do you think it had?
Well, I think that it puts the possibility on the table. I think that a strike, it reminds so many people that labor resistance is a thing. And I think that the possibility of athletic labor, the possibility of labor solidarity and resistance and collective athletic activism has so much potential. And that's what now is in conversation. It's on the table. You heard Jaylen Brown say this. We can do it again if we need to.
Okay, well, we're going to pick up more on that thought when we come back. We're talking about sports activism, its present, its past, and its future. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about activism in sports, its present, its past, and its future. I'm joined today by Amira Rose Davis. She's a professor of history and African American studies at Penn State University, and also, Amira, I'm going to get this right, and also host of the Burn It All Down podcast. And Howard Bryant joins us as well. He's senior writer at ESPN and author of several books, including Full Dissidence. And Howard, before the break, I had asked Amira about whether the short duration of this sort of widespread collective activism across a lot of American professional athletics, if the short duration sort of limited its impact. And I want to know what your thoughts are on that.
happened. Once again, several calls from many, many people around different sports leagues, from baseball to basketball to football and other sports. And some people really did feel like, okay, the moment's over. You had the leverage, you had everyone's attention, and by immediately going back to work, you lost your momentum. I'm not sure I agree with that. I feel like this is a very delicate thing for athletics and for sports and for the players, because number one, I mean, they still have a job. This is still their occupation. And I think one of the things that I'd been thinking about was that we're going to find out the limits of what these players are going to be able to impact, that everyone has a lane in this, and that there's going to be some of your visibility that you're going to be able to use to affect what's happening. And then there is going to be some other areas where your symbolic gestures are more important than sitting home for the rest of the year. However, it is important to remember that we are in the middle of a perfect storm here. And let's not forget COVID. Let's not forget all of these other things that are affecting this. Let's also not forget the fact that that a lot of this action took place because the stadium was empty. Would it have been the exact same thing if you had had 20,000 people in the stands waiting for you to come out and perform? So I felt like I thought it was appropriate. And I also understood that there are numerous directions this could have gone in, and also very mindful of the fact that even before the reopening, there were several players in the WNBA and the NBA who were saying, maybe it's not appropriate for us to come out and play at all. So this has always been lingering, the fact that in this bubble, there had been this thought, why are we even here? So it just started to escalate.
Mm-hmm. And Amir, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I think that, you know, Natasha Cloud, Renee Montgomery, the people opted out of, you know, WNBA players especially, of playing and saying, no, we're going to take this time to focus on racial justice, to focus on social justice, because this is bigger than basketball right now. So that kind of fever was already in the air. I think the perfect storm is so key. I think it influences league decisions. Like if they don't have, you know, they can't fill stadium seats, right? It removes one of the kind of immediate impediments to a lot of, you know, their reaction before, which is like, what about the ticket holders? And it's like, well, you don't have fans right now. And how does that change how you think about branding your league? How does that change about what's possible? I think that the bubble and the wobble itself are just fascinating spaces. I mean, their existence is an ode to capitalism, because like, did we really need to rush back to basketball in the middle of a global pandemic? You know, but at the same time, it's a space where there is a level of conversation and accessibility and pause that many people, not just in basketball, have articulated as giving them time to think. I've talked to many college athletes, right, who have been able to use this time to mobilize in new ways. I've talked to Tiana Bartoletta, U.S. Olympian, who is part of the formation of an organization that has brought together track and field athletes around the globe, because everybody's been at home. There's no Olympic trials. There's no lead up to that. And they've been sitting on Zoom and figuring out how can we come together collectively and mobilize for more governance of our sport, to get away from Rule 50 and be able to protest at the Olympic Games. And these are things that are happening because we're sitting at this moment in the middle of a budding revolution, in the middle of a global pandemic. And I think that that has to be the context for this whole discussion.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I was going to say, I'm sorry, make it go. Go ahead. It's your show.
No, please. No, actually, I'll be perfectly honest. Sitting and listening and learning from the both of you is really what my goal is here. So go ahead, Howard.
Well, I was going to say that, one, to Amira's point, I do question whether or not this is a revolution at all. This is why sometimes it's even more important to watch and see what happens and withhold your judgment. The one part of this that I do think, though, is very powerful, and that this is sort of one of the bookmarks to this time period, is that I think Naomi Osaka said it best when she gave her reasons for withdrawing from Western and Southern, when she said that there are just more important things happening right now than watching me play tennis. And I love the way she phrased that, because she didn't say there are more important things than tennis right now. She said there are more important things than watching me play tennis, which was the message to you, the public, that we are withholding our services right now, that we are telling you that we're not going to contribute to the distraction, that your eyes don't need to be on my serve and my forehand. Your eyes need to be on Minneapolis, and your eyes need to be on Kenosha, and your eyes need to be on DC and New York and everything else that's happening right here. So I think that this is an interesting thing when we're talking about empowerment, that the players are saying, hey, if you're going to pay attention to us, here's what we want you to pay attention to. And I think there are limits to that. And I think that's one of the reasons why this balance is so key, to decide when you are leveraged and when you're over-leveraged. It will be very interesting to see when we get back to normal, what the leagues decide to do. It's easy for them to, or easier for them to get involved now because everything seems to be up for grabs in the middle of this pandemic. But when they have to deal with fan pressure, when they have to deal with the other side, because there is another side to this, which is the season ticket holders, and when all of that business comes in, they'll find out how much stamina they have in order to stand the idea that Black Lives Matter is on the pitcher's mound and on the sidelines and in the stands right now, and it's part of the optics when you watch a game, is a really powerful thing. And it's also a very unpopular thing in a lot of places. So once again, I think the leagues are going to find out the limits, or they're going to find out what their actual stamina is. And the players are going to find that out, too. It's a little bit easier for them to do it right now. I appreciated the fact that they did what they did. But I also know that there's always a backlash when you go down these roads.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think we already know that it's going to be extremely challenging because the backlash against athletes, even in just recent history, has been swift and powerful and lasting. And so we'll come back to that here in just a second. But since both of you mentioned the WNBA, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about their leadership on this, because we talked to WNBA guard Blake Dietrich. She plays for the Atlanta Dream. And here's a part of what she told us.
Initially, I wasn't so sure. And I was a little bit frustrated because I didn't feel like we had given actionable items to follow with choosing to sit out of those games. But then I heard from people who I haven't heard from in years. My freshman year roommate from Princeton was like, hey, you probably don't have my number anymore, but we see you. We are so proud of what the league has done. And like, it gives me chills just talking about it now, because it just, we went outside of the basketball world in that statement.
Now, as we mentioned, the WNBA and its players, actually, I should specifically say players, have been some of the most outspoken athletes anywhere in sports against police brutality and racial injustice. And that includes white players like Dietrich.
We need white voices to speak up as well. I will reach a different audience than my Black teammate will. And so for people in my circle on social media to see that I am supporting and posting these same things, it matters. I wish it didn't, but at the end of the day, it makes a difference.
And as we've been talking about, though, these actions come at potentially high cost, and athletes are taking a risk. I mean, for example, in the case of Dietrich and her team, the team is co-owned by Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican from Georgia. And Loeffler, in July, ripped into her own team. In a letter sent to the WNBA president, Senator Loeffler claimed that the Black Lives Matter movement, quote, promotes violence and destruction, and Loeffler urged the WNBA to put American flags on its jersey as, quote, a unifying rallying point for the American people. Now, Dietrich and her fellow teammates, they really pushed back hard on this. They've called for Loeffler to sell the team. The senator says she will not. The players went on to wear T-shirts supporting Loeffler's opponent in Georgia's upcoming special election.
Several people have made the comment, oh, well, you're still taking a paycheck from her. How does that make you feel? Or you're still aligning with her in some way if she's paying your bills? But quite honestly, for me, I don't think it could be any more of a statement to continue to take her money while also supporting her opponent. So for me, that's kind of where I stand on it.
So that's Blake Dietrich with the Atlanta Dream. Amira, can you talk more about sort of the players at the WNBA and what's, I don't know if the situation with the Dream is unique, but what's the relationship between the players, their action, and the league itself?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I can start with the Loeffler situation because this has been a storm brewing because, I mean, whether she's Loeffler has been engaging in insider trading or, you know, whatever, it's always been a kind of tenuous relationship. But one of the things the players particularly were in objection to with this was that it's very clear she's in a runoff, a special election, whatever, that she was doing what too many politicians, from the occupant of the White House down, do, which is use this as political football points. Like it's too easy, right, to throw this as red meat to her supposed base in an election year. And the players felt it was really clearly, they felt like pawns within that. And that was a lot of what motivated them to go and to wear vote shorts and support her opponents. But yeah, I think the league is so interesting. They have been on the forefront of this for years. I mean, we heard quotes and stuff from years ago at the beginning of Colin Kaepernick and others, but the Minnesota Lynx, for instance, wore shirts in the wake of Philando Castile's death. They refused to take presser comments on anything but police brutality. You know, they got a fine from the league for dress code violations for these shirts that they were wearing until social media kind of caught hold of it. And there was enough pressure from NBA players and other people around social media to say, you can't assess this fine, a $500 fine per shirt, while you're celebrating other activists, other athletes who are being outspoken. And so I think there's a way that the league has had to come into its position as completely behind in supporting their players. I think over the last few years, there's been this way where they're like, we are leaning into it, but also seeking to control it. And so a few years ago, their commercial for their season was using images of the Women's March, and they announced the sit down or take a seat, take a stand initiative where they were partnering with various social justice organizations because of the work that women were doing. But out of the five organizations that they chose, including Planned Parenthood, none of them were specific to racial justice, police brutality. And I think that was really, to me, representative of this kind of tense relationship where you have predominantly Black women on the team pushing the league in this direction and the league needing to be pulled along. And it feels like in the last year, especially, they've like run and caught up, whether it's supporting Maya Moore as she stepped away from the game or, you know, just where they are now in terms of being all in on it.
Howard, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I felt like the WNBA, we seem to forget, obviously, we always treat the four major sports as if there aren't four major sports, and then also, you know, major sports. The WNBA is not a different sport. It's not the fifth major sport. It's the fourth major sport that's a women's league. And when you follow what they've done, and I think part of the reason is obviously they're, we're asking the tennis player Martina Navratilova about this, about why did the women seem to be so much more engaged and focused and bold. And she said, well, because we're women. This is how we do. This is what we have to do. And we've had to fight for ourselves. And when you look at what the WNBA has done, they have been far less timid. They're not timid at all about this. They're taking on an owner. It is a unique thing to take on an owner, and it certainly is a unique thing to take on your own owner who owns the team. And to the point where you start to even wonder about these phrases to call someone an owner of a team that's named the Dream. It's the images are all so uncomfortable. But I think that the area that I'm really pleased with is that they are recognizing that they have a value question. And when you look at the history of this on the men's side, going back to Jackie Robinson, you can't name five players. You can't name five white players, just one hand, who really leaned in and said, I support you as a teammate and that I'm willing to take the same risk you're taking and that this is not a Black issue, this is an American issue. But the WNBA players have done that, and they've done it in such a way that it's actually not only is it impressive on their part, but it's really embarrassing when you think about the history of it on the men's side.
Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little bit more about that history? We've rightfully been focused on the events of the past week or even a couple of months here. But there's forever been this tension of when athletes choose to take the risk to speak out. I mean, decade after decade, they have been met first, I think, with very strong pushback. I mean, Howard, let me just give you a quick crack at this. Do you think that that's actually one of the things that might be changing now, or do you not see it all that different from, say, what we played that tape from Muhammad Ali in 1967?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's actually driving this, because let's not forget the sports world is the place of the ultimate paternalism. It's anger, it's paternalism, it's anger on the part of the public that is upset that these golden youths get to make so much money for what they consider to be playing a game, even though their level of job security is less than ours, their level of competition is greater than ours. And I think that this idea, just the paternalism of calling them owners, where in every other industry, their chief executives or managing partners or whomever, or whatever you want to call them, we'll call them owners. And so you're starting to see that. And then you see the resentment as well from the public. We pay your salary. Once again, that paternalism of being grateful to, you know, for your position. And so much of that is rooted in this the racism in this country. And I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing that's why there's so much anger when the players actually demonstrate a little bit of self-determination. And I think historically, it is one of these areas where the fan is going to determine, well, should we come back or we shouldn't? We'll see what we do with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll pick up on that thought when we come back. We are talking about the present, the history, and the future of activism in sports. There's a lot more to come. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about the present, the past, and the future of activism in sports. And, you know, there has been a lot of pushback when athletes have spoken out on issues of politics and American life. I mean, particularly when it comes to issues of race and police violence, or even just straight up who's in the White House. For example, after NBA stars LeBron James and Kevin Durant voiced their criticism of President Trump in 2018, here's what Fox News's Laura Ingraham had to say.
It's always unwise to seek political advice from someone who gets paid $100 million a year to bounce a ball. Oh, and LeBron and Kevin, you're great players, but no one voted for you. Millions elected Trump to be their coach. So keep the political commentary to yourself, or as someone once said, shut up and dribble.
Well, a couple of days later, just ahead of the 2018 NBA All-Star Game, LeBron James made it clear that he would not stop speaking.
We will definitely not shut up and dribble. And I've always said that at the end of the day, I do it because I'm passionate about it. I do it because I know that this is bigger than just me personally. The hardest thing in the world for me personally is raising two African-American boys and an African-American daughter in today's society. It's hard.
LeBron James in 2018. Well, I'm joined today by Howard Bryant. He's a commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, author of many books, including Full Dissidence, and Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State University, and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. And I want to bring in one more voice into this conversation. Etan Thomas is a former NBA player, an activist. He writes for The Guardian as well. He's also author of We Matter, Athletes and Activism. Etan, welcome to On Point.
Yo, thanks for having me.
So first of all, talk about what we just heard about the swift reaction that happens when players choose to speak out. Do you see the possibility of that changing at all, given the fact that at least this year there has been such a persistent or consistent groundswell of support amongst many Americans overall for grappling with issues of race and police violence?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think it's going to change anything. I had the honor of interviewing a lot of athlete activists from the past and the present in my book, We Matter, Athletes and Activism. And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar told me that, you know, he was told to shut up and dribble back in the 60s. Bill Russell told me the same thing. I mean, everybody loved him when he was winning championships with Boston. But then as soon as he started talking about the segregation and, you know, racist practices, then they told him to shut up and dribble as well. So that part isn't necessarily new. But I think that what you see from the right and the people like Laura Ingraham and Jared Kushner and Trump and everybody else from the right, Tucker Carlson, that they have a vile reaction to athletes no matter what, if they disagree with what they're saying. So if they agree with what they're saying, then they're going to applaud you. Then it's like, okay, you're great. Here, let's bring you to the convention and have you speak and to be the black faces that we can point to and say, see, they agree with me. But then if they disagree with you, then there's going to be nothing but, you know, shut up, stay in your place, stay in your lane. You don't know what you're talking about. And that's what's typically happened in the past, and it's going to just continue in the future.
So yeah, if Howard, just let me just ask this quick question. I'm not sure I know the right way to ask it. So jump in here as soon as I'm done, and I have a watch alarm going off. I'm really sorry about that. But I'm just wondering from the fans' perspective. Okay, here, just give me the benefit of the doubt for a moment.
Okay.
That one of the reasons why sports is so central and important to American life is that it really provides something that people don't get anywhere else. It provides the pure joy, the pure tragedy, the pinnacle of human capacity and skill. It provides an escape, like all of these things that fans turn to sports for that they cannot find anywhere else. And I'm going to leave politicians aside and just, again, thinking of fans, that when they sort of bristle at politics entering that space, I mean, it just doesn't feel like that. This is one place in which they just want to experience a whole different way of living, viewing, thinking, feeling that's an escape from the rest of life. I mean, that's overly simplistic. I get it. But I'm trying to understand sort of why one of the reasons why athletes continuously get this kind of pushback. Again, not just from presidents, but even from the very people who buy the tickets.
Yeah, sure. Well, they get it because there's a huge level of selfishness here, that you're here to entertain me. This belongs to me. And that you don't have it as the labor. You don't have the right to any sort of self-determination. I don't have to care about you as a person. You are here to provide a service for me. And if that is the case, then you should watch the movies. Then you should watch television, because those are already taped and they're already completed. But in a live setting, then the players are the pushback that the players are saying is that if you're going to enjoy my talents, if you're going to respect my abilities to put a ball through a hoop, then you're going to have to respect me as a human being as well. And this is exactly right. I always say, Natan and Amir have heard this a million times from me, that when you look at the pyramid of American sports, it's white owners, white coaches, white season ticket holders, white media, black player. That's the filter through the way this game works. And the question has always been the collision is, does that labor level, the black player, does that player have any sort of self-determination, or are they simply here to entertain? And what you're seeing is the players are saying, listen, we are going to force you to pay attention to us as people. And I've got $40 million in the bank. Absolutely. And that's even more reason why you're going to have to pay attention to me, because we listen to people who have money in this culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing, you know, the question is, well, what fans are you talking about? Because there is a lot of Black fans who, you know, yeah, there's a lot of Black fans who experience that very differently, who experience joy and you know, empowerment, right, when people are speaking out. But moreover, I think one of the things that Howard's pointing to, and if we look at the history of this, Black people in this country have been able to occupy spaces as entertainers, whether it's through sports, through music, through Nancy Green selling pancakes for Aunt Jemima, right? That is a avenue that has been made available in this country. It has given the platform that so many of them speak out from. And that genealogy of Shut Up and Dribble underscores this idea that you are literally only there as an entertainer. You're there to do that. That's why it's so hard to think about them as laborers, to think about them as workers. That's why that first kind of, if you have that bingo card of reactions to any athletic activism, that first thing that you're going to get all the time is you make this much money, or you play a game, you know, you're entitled, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that is, you know, just historically speaking, it's very, very clear that this is a site. It's such a central site to American society, but it's a site that is used to either try to enforce these ideas of meritocracy, right? We're all running the same race, et cetera, et cetera. And when Black athletes in that space turn it on its head and say, well, actually, guess what? I have a voice. And actually, let me tell you from this platform that you built, right, that this is, I'm not going to be the only Black person you know when you're sitting in your suburbs on the TV. Like, I'm going to actually have a voice to match with what my physical body is doing. And that has long been disruptive, but sports are inherently political. And so I think that there's certainly a level of desire for escapism. But I mean, I think it comes down to this idea of like, well, what fans are we talking about? That filter, that system that Howard's talking about is certainly one of capital where it flows, but it also is ignoring large fan bases that are left out of the conversation because they don't have access to stadiums or ticket sales or et cetera. And it really belies the entire structure of sporting institutions in society. But what we know historically is that athletes have never shied away from speaking up. And there's also been always, like we said before, that pushback to it.
Right. Eitan, did you want to say something?
Yeah, sure. I think that a lot of times fans have to understand that it's not really, this isn't a political issue. This is a human issue. So when you're saying the Black Lives Matter, that shouldn't fall into any kind of political line. You're saying that your specific life and the life of your people should matter to society, who has shown us that our lives do not matter. And, you know, it's interesting going back to my book, I got the chance to interview different current athletes who have been speaking out and using their voices. So like Russell Westbrook, for instance, he was with the Thunder when I interviewed him, but I asked him, you know, why did he feel the need to speak out when Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma was killed by the police, Officer Betty Shelby? And he said, because, you know, I look around in the stands and I see all these fans, you know, cheering my name and wearing my jersey and all these things like that. But after I leave the stadium and I'm driving home, if my car was broken down, like in Terrence Crutcher's case, and a police officer came up to me, would they look at me as a threat? And he's like, I can't tell you that they wouldn't. They just see a Black man and I'm immediately a threat. So that's been the recurring theme that every person I interviewed said is the reason of why they're speaking out. Carmelo Anthony talked about Freddie Gray in Baltimore, where he was from, you know, and, you know, Dwayne Wade talked about how he feared for his sons after Trayvon Martin was killed. And Geraldo Rivera said, well, it's because of the hoodies. And he said, well, wait a minute, my sons wear hoodies all the time. And if you put a hoodie on my son, he looks just like Trayvon Martin. So you're telling me that my son is now a target? So it's a very human issue. It has nothing to do with politics. So what fans have to understand is that, you know, for players, you know, we're playing and, you know, I'm retired now. I'm not playing anymore. But when I did play, you know, we're playing on the court and there. But as soon as it's over, we're still going out to society, and there is no escape for us. You know, there is no break for us there, you know, from the reality. We deal with the reality as soon as the game ends. And that's why having athletes speak out on that reality of people who they're not listening to right now. You know what I mean? Because athletes have a voice. So when LeBron says something, people hear it. And not only do they hear it because, you know, because their space is being invaded and LeBron is saying it while they're looking at him, but they're also hearing it because they are fans of LeBron's. So then that puts a human side to it. Like, wait a minute. You know, so this issue that we've been hearing about that we thought the people, all these black people were just exaggerating about and everything like that, that LeBron actually feels this way too? Wow, let me pay a little bit closer attention to this. And that's why it's so important for athletes to keep using their voices and using their celebrity to bring attention to an issue that affects all black people.
So can you tell me more about how, as you were saying, like there's no escape for you, whether you're on the court or off, right? Because you are who you are in this country. Can you tell me about more about how that has had an impact on your life?
Oh man, it's had a tremendous impact. So I'm me and my wife are blessed to have three children. And my oldest son, he just turned 15. So that means in a year, he'll be driving. And I am literally terrified for him. Like, I don't even really want him to drive. You know what I mean? So every time that something like this happens, like, I can't sleep at night. See, and that's the thing, though. You know, when white America reads these different things and, you know, they're looking at it and it's a story. And then they look at the details of it. It's like, well, did he resist arrest? You know, did this happen? They're looking at it like that. I'm immediately looking at it like that could have been me. Like that could have been my son. That could have been somebody who I am close to. You know what I mean? Because when I am driving, we have had situations where we're driving and pulled over by the police. The rules for black people when we're pulled over by the police are completely different than rules for white people. White people can cuss out the police, go off on the police. Why did you stop me? I'll have your badge. We better not even think about saying anything like that. We have to be in full compliance, and it still might not be enough. So that's where this impacts us. This is not, and that's why going back to, this isn't a political issue, you know, like at all. This is a human issue. And to have to push for police accountability and police reform also, that's not anti-police. Every system is supposed to have checks and balances and accountability. That's having, you know, you valuing the police, but understanding that they cannot have carte blanche to do whatever they want to do, because that puts you and your family at risk. That's the connection. It has nothing to do with politics whatsoever.
Yeah.
Was that you, Howard?
Yeah, it's me. And when you listen to these stories, it gets so tiring. I mean, it really does. It's exhausting in so many different ways, because the bottom line is that these subjects, you talk about fan pushback, is that the economics of it are clear, and Amira is right as well, is that when we talk about the fan, we talk about the fan as this sort of monolithic block of white fans and not the tens of millions of black fans who are talking, and the tens of millions of white fans who are talking to the players and said, hey, good for you guys. Let's not forget that for 40 years, it was Nike and Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods and everybody else that said nothing. Part of the reason why this period is so important is because you're actually finally hearing from them after decades of silence. And so the exhaustion does come from the, I tell my son who just turned 16, Etan, he's about to go get his learner's permit. I tell him all the time that we don't beg for our humanity in this house. And yet the entire culture so far of where we are post George Floyd and even before that has been, please, please don't, you know, hurt us and recognize that we're the same as you. And you see this in an election year and all of this perfect storm. At the end of the day, I applaud the athletes for what they're doing, because all they're doing is really what we've asked them to do. Remember all those years? Well, how come Jordan didn't say anything? And how come Magic didn't say anything? And how come after Rodney King, the players didn't speak up? Now their players are speaking and they want them to be quiet. So they're being citizens. They're really not doing that much more than that. It's what we want them to do.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I can't thank the three of you enough for joining us today. Howard Bryant, senior writer at ESPN and commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, author of Full Dissidence and The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Amira Rose Davis, assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State and co-host of Burn It All Down. Amira, thank you so very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
and Eitan Thomas, former NBA player, contributor to The Guardian, and author of We Matter, Athletes and Activism. Eitan, thank you so very much.
Oh, thanks for having me. Bless.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.